Hey, everybody, we'll be right back, but first, a word from our sponsors. All right, options traders, listen up. I want to tell you a bit about Public.com, but first, have you ever actually thought about all the fees you're paying to trade options? Aside from the regulatory fees, there are commissions, and most platforms charge per contract fees too. That's what makes today's sponsor, Public.com, so interesting. Public doesn't charge commissions or pre-contract fees. And in an industry first, they offer a rebate of up to 18 cents per option contract traded. Check it out. If you trade 1,000 option contracts on Public, you'll get up to $180 in rebates. If you trade 10,000 contracts, you could earn almost $2,000. More importantly, the rebate means you can maximize your profits and minimize your losses. So to recap, no commissions, no per contract fees, and up to 18 cents on every contract traded. See why NerdWallet recently awarded Public 5 stars for options trading and start earning up to 18 cents per contract traded only at public.com. Paid for by Public Investing. Options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures and podcast description, U.S. members only.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Investing Unscripted, where we ask and answer the hard questions about investing. I'm Jason Hall, joined as usual by my very good friend. You've been promoted, Jeff.
I've been upgraded. I'm usually just a good friend. This is nice.
That's right. Very good friend. Voice of the people, Jeff Santoro. How are you, buddy?
I am doing great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited for two reasons. One reason, we have a wonderful guest who's going to be on. He's going to give us some interesting insights. We're going to bring that guest on in just a minute. But this is a special episode for another reason too, Jeff.
It is. This is actually our 100th official episode. We've done actually more than 100 if you count the first Friday live streams and also some of our rough cuts. But as far as like scheduled, planned out, purposefully recorded episodes go, this is number 100. So that's a nice little landmark for us. So it's exciting.
A century of episodes. I love it. We, as usual, we also have a century of housekeeping. What's our housekeeping, Jeff?
It's all the normal things, just encouraging everyone to reach out with questions and show ideas. We've actually gotten a decent number of ideas for shows from some listeners recently. So keep those coming. If you have any questions you want us to answer on the next mailbag, you can email us or hit us up on social media at any point. We keep a running list of questions so that we have a lot to answer when we do our mailbags. And as always, ratings and reviews on the podcast apps are very appreciated.
All right. How about reach into the green room and we'll bring our guest on?
Yeah, let's go. I'll go get him and then you can introduce him.
Okay, sounds good. Well, while you're going to get him, I'll go ahead and read him in. I am excited to welcome Tim Hansen to the show. Tim Hansen, who is the co-president, chief investing officer at Permanent Equity. Prior to that, spent some time at Motley Fool Asset Management, is a smart man, a knowledgeable investor, and somebody who has some really interesting insights. Also, Tim, my favorite thing about you that I get to experience is the little newsletter that you do every day. How are you, Tim?
I'm good. Thank you for being a subscriber. That's been a fun project to do over the past year.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that because you're in season two, as you call it.
Season three.
Oh, that's right. That's right. The way it's structured, it's technically season three. And it's Unqualified Opinions is the name of it, right? Mm-hmm. Unqualified Opinions. And I encourage people to find it and to sign up for it because it's a lot of fun. So before we get into your background, this is a question that's not on the script. It wasn't part of our outline. Why? And you've talked about it a little bit in the newsletter, but why in the hell did you decide to commit to doing something where you're basically writing just about every day for most of the year?
Well, two things. Personally, after I turned 40, I decided to challenge myself to see if I could try to find something interesting to say every day. And in order to say something interesting every day, you have to do something interesting every day. And so that's sort of been my personal challenge. And it doesn't work out every day, but it's been fun to try to get after it. You know, and then secondarily, you know, at Permanent Equity, you know, we invest a lot of time and money and resources in content because we believe content scales conversations. And in our neck of the woods and in our line of business, you know, relationships matter. You know, we think of the three pillars of our business as being capital, opportunities, and then people, talent. And all three of those things are, in our opinion, just made so much easier to access and build relationships with if we're scaling conversations through content. So that's why, you know, we've got the daily newsletter. It's why Brent, our founder and president, CEO, writes so much. We go on podcasts, we have books, we have drawings. you know, we just want to be out in the world. And if we're out in the world and we're out in the world every day, talent and opportunities tend to find us rather than us having to go look for them. And you know, I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but that's the big difference between private investing and public investing. For me, at least, is public, all those opportunities are listed and everybody can go look at them. In private, there's no list. You got to go dig them up somehow.
Well, another thing too about doing something every day, and if you try to do something well every day, you get a little bit better at it over time, and that certainly can pay off, I'm sure.
Yeah, you can't. There's no substitute for reps, you know, in anything, whether it's investing or sports or, you know, you just got to do something over and over and over again. And when you do it enough, you know, it gets easier and the results get a little bit better, I hope.
Let's talk about your background a little bit there. So I mentioned you spent some time at the Motley Fool Asset Management for a while. You were there over a decade, I believe. And I think you've been at Permanent Equity for going on 6 years.
Yeah,
now?
A little more than 5 years here in Missouri. Yeah, prior to that, I was at the Fool from, let's see, it was 2005 to 2018. And I was in asset management, the regulated business, but also had an opportunity to work for the publishing side, work on the website. I did some copywriting. You know, when I got hired, you probably know the history of the company well. Maybe not everybody does, though. When I got hired in 2005, you know, they were rebuilding after the dot-com implosion. And so it was a really fun time to be there because they were kind of figuring out the business model and everybody got to wear a lot of hats. And that's something I like to do professionally. It's one of the reasons I you know, joined Permanent Equity 5 years ago, was just the opportunity to do a lot of different things rather than, you know, have to stay in a lane.
So when we have guests on too, we like to connect the human element here too, from being somebody that's a pro in the investing world and the asset management world in the capital allocation universe to, how did you get there? The little boy Tim, where did little boy Tim come from? And what's your origin story? How did you end up in this world that we all live in?
Yeah, it's funny. We had a running joke here. So when I originally came out to Permanent Equity, I was hired in as the chief financial officer, the CFO. And Brent's joke about me was that I was the most underqualified CFO in America because I have a fairly alternative background with regards to, you know, financial and investing stuff. You know, like a lot of people who work at the Fool, you know, my initial exposure to investing came through my dad. My dad was a scientist, but a hobbyist investor, and built spreadsheets on the weekends and tracked his stocks and so on and so forth. And so it just kind of got imbued in me at a young age that you could go out and you could buy businesses and businesses could do productive things with your money and then you'd make more money. So that was fun. But my interest coming out of high school was writing and government, and I ended up going to school in DC, which is how I found my way down there. I graduated in 2003, which was still kind of reeling from the job market at that point, was still reeling a little bit from the dot-com stuff and then also September 11th. And so I ended up, you know, I got exactly one job offer, and it was in government as a speechwriter. And I took it, and within, 6 months of doing it, I realized that politics was not for me. And so I started looking around for other things. You know, my major in college was playwriting, but my dad made me get a minor in something more practical, which was finance. And so I was a little bit dangerous with numbers. And so combining that interest.
Well, you take an expert with words and give them just a little bit of enough to be dangerous with numbers and, oh boy. And,
yeah, no, that's exactly it. You know, we say in one of the letters recently, you know, it's one thing to have a great financial idea, but you also have to be able to convince people of it that's a good idea so that they take it. So that was kind of my combination. And, you know, I had, when I was working in the government, obviously, you know, I was making money and they had a retirement plan and I was putting money aside. And that was how I found the Fool, was just kind of looking around for helpful advice. And when I realized they were local to DC and I wanted to kind of switch gears out of government, I applied for I think the job title back then was like fact checker and, you know, just kind of work on everything, and got that job. Stayed there for, you know, 13 years, worked on some of their research publications, helped launch and run the asset management business. And then my last job there was working with some of the software developers and a team of data scientists to just kind of like ingest data from all of the analysts at the company to figure out. I mean, fundamentally, we were trying to answer the question, like, who was lucky and who was good? And if you were good, what were you good at and how might you get better? And it was in the course of doing that that I think my epiphany was that I thought, it was becoming harder to find edge in the public markets. Like, multiples were going up. Momentum was becoming a more important factor to returns. My passion had always been like small companies and emerging markets, like weird kind of out of the way niche stuff. And I met Brent. Morgan Housel introduced me to Brent because one of the business development things we were doing at the time at The Fool was wondering if we should, within the asset management business, start a money, a private equity fund, which might use the subscriber base as a source of proprietary business acquisition opportunities. We never did it, but that was how I met Brent, was doing kind of project-based research around that market initiative.
And Brent Beshore, the CEO and founder
of Permanent Equity, right?
Right.
And you know, they're out here in Middle Missouri buying small companies, trying to make them better. And it just seemed like the opportunity to add value. You know, we've got four pillars that we can add value in our business, which is, you know, we can source proprietary deals, we can negotiate proprietary price and terms, and then we get to run them post-close or help run them post-close and staff them with people. And so there's just more levers to pull than you see in the public markets. And so those combination of factors are what prompted the transition from, you know, DC and public equities to Columbia, Missouri and small private companies.
So that's a perfect segue to what I wanted to ask about, Tim. So we talk a lot about public investing on this podcast. A couple months ago, we had Joe Madgier on to talk about venture capital, and you live in the world of private equity now. So as the person on this podcast who has the least amount of experience with investing, I was hoping you could give us listeners.
Very, very long, long measure.
I was hoping you give us all a quick, maybe 30-second primer on like, what is private equity? Because I think if you're a newer investor, you hear that term thrown around a lot, and I don't know that it's super clear what it is. And then maybe even go a little further into what you guys do at Permanent Equity that's a little bit different than maybe the traditional private equity you might hear about.
Sure. I mean, so private equity comes in a million different flavors, and it's mostly just, you know, investors who identify pools of capital that they then deploy in novel ways into businesses that are private. And so there are far fewer, for the most part, rules and regulations around that. Most of the investors who are making investments in private equity are going to be, you know, qualified investors or institutional investors. There are fewer individual investors making private equity investments, which in some ways is sad because it's an interesting opportunity set. But, you know, the government wants to make sure people don't get taken advantage of, because when there are less rules, there's also more latitude for people to do bad things. And, you know, you guys probably are aware, like, you know, public stocks are considered a level one asset, right? Which is, if you have a share of Google, you can type it into the computer and know immediately what it's worth. You know, everything that we are transacting in is what's considered like a level three asset, which means there are no observable inputs into what it's worth. So you get to build a model and you get to make up the number. And, you know, we try to be intellectually honest about that, but candidly, some people. So that's one thing. You know, historically, private equity, you know, you've got like that barbarian at the gates, you know, history.
Yeah, it's funny because I was going to mention that too. That's the image that most people have, right?
Yeah,
the leveraged buyout.
Exactly, which is
giant private business. And they're just trying to do one thing, and that's trying to buy something as cheap as they can with as little of their own money as possible.
Yep.
And then as soon as they can, within a few years, polish that turd, sell it for a higher multiple.
Yep.
And send the debt out the door with it, right? Yep. That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
Best leverage returns they can get.
And then take their carry. Exactly right. And so, you know, historically, you know, and it's not a perception because it's wrong. You know, there's a lot of leverage, people being aggressive about cost cutting. You hear a lot of horror stories about what people do within a private equity strategy, but that's not private equity writ large. It's just, you know, it's a strategy within the universe of private equity. So, you know,
it's the splashy part if it bleeds, it reads, that ends up on the Wall Street Journal, right?
For certain. And I mean, you know, when they hit home runs, they hit really big home runs, because when you use a lot of debt, you you get multiple expansion, you're able to make the business better, or you're able to do tack on acquisitions and things, you can create, you know, a big exit. And that's what a lot of private equity firms are in the business of doing, which is, you know, spend 3 years trying to buy something, 3 years trying to build it and run it, and make it, polish it, as you said, and then 3 years trying to sell it and be done. You know, we do things differently. So our kind of mission statement here is that we want to just help more American small businesses stay independent and thrive. And so we take a view of being very long-term, and we use no debt. So, you know, people who know us know, you know, our funds have 27-year durations. We have 10 years to invest the capital that we've raised. We charge no management fees of any kind, and we only get paid when we make distributions of excess free cash flow back out to our investors. And so we're aligned around trying to make, you know, really smart long-term decisions to gradually grow these businesses over time. And the solution that we're trying to provide to the marketplace is, you know, right now there are, you know, thousands and thousands of small businesses, small and medium-sized businesses These are businesses that are earning probably somewhere between $2 and $25 million a year that are being run by people who may have founded them or a second generation family member who really don't have a transition plan, but they care deeply about their employees. They care deeply about their community, their customers, all their stakeholders. And so they want to figure out how they can transition into retirement while also maintaining the health of the business and put it in a safe pair of hands that's going to, you know, not lever it up, not flip it in 3 years, not compromise their standing in the community. And so we're able to offer those folks a very differentiated value proposition when it comes time to do that. And like I said, you know, because of our content and whatnot, a lot of them find us and they say, hey, I own a business. Would you mind taking a look at it and see if it's something you'd be interested in? And so, and we love that because ultimately money is a factor, but when we like it when money's not the only factor. So we try to be competitive on, and fair on valuation, but we want to win a deal on the merits of other stuff, which is it's a great fit. We can be helpful. You know, people, the seller cares what happens next. And so if you go through our portfolio, which is on our website, you know, there's stories behind each of those about, you know, why we got that deal and somebody else didn't.
So how much, this is just kind of a making of the sausage question, but I'm curious because I know typically with private equity, a PE firm or maybe a more than one might work together on deals depending on the size. They fully acquire a business. Is that typical of what permanent equity does? Or do you co-invest? Do you partner with owners and buy a stake?
Yeah,
is there so a mix of it?
We think of our product as money, for lack of a better term, and our customers are sellers. And so we offer them kind of two solutions. One, we call the legacy buyout. This is typically where we're buying somewhere between 80 to 100% of the business, and the leadership either wants to retire in short order or within a few years. And so we're trying to figure out what that looks like and how we transition leadership as they go into retirement. Secondarily, we have what we call the growth partnership. And this is because, not having a long-term time horizon and not using leverage isn't something that only older people are interested in. We found that people of all ages can be interested in it, of the right mindset. People are, you know, travels well in different geographies. You know, a lot of private equity, smaller private equity firms will have like a Southeast focus or a Northeast focus. You know, our business is all over the country because people are coming to our value set. And so a growth partnership is typically a founder who's going to be between the ages of, you know, call it 35 and 55. They want to stay with the business for the next 10 to 30 years, but they're looking for someone. They probably want to take some chips off the table, maybe because, you know, they've got a family or they've got colleges to pay for and all their assets are wrapped up in one investment, which is the business. Mm-hmm. So they want to bring in a helpful partner, but not someone who's going to, you know, again, lever it up or change the way that the business is run. And so in those cases, we're usually buying somewhere between 51 and 70%. We always take a control position just because, you know, because we have a 27-year horizon. We can't be a passenger. We've got to be a driver. But, you know, our partners are all incented in the same way. Like I said, we've tried to build everything around distributions of excess free cash flow so that if we choose to take our cash flow and reinvest it, you know, our investors are foregoing their return. We're foregoing our fee and the CEO is foregoing a bonus in the hopes that that cash is going to be reinvested at high rates of return. But if we pay the cash out, you know, that's what we bonus our CEOs on. We then take our fee and obviously our investors get their return. So that's kind of how the business model works.
So thinking about that versus, I mean, it's we've kind of already answered in the conversation, but I think just to kind of lay it out there for those that didn't hear, I'll mention this too. And want to just mention it again, try to mention it every show when we have an interview, especially go to investingunscripted.com and sign up for the newsletter and you can get the transcript when we drop a new episode. And for this one, all the things we're talking about, there'll be links throughout it that can be helpful. So we did the interview with Joe Magier, Tim, and one of our former colleagues at the Motley Fool as well, spent a lot of time in Australia and has since transitioned into venture capital. We talked about it a little bit in that interview with Joe, but thinking about venture capital versus private equity, and again, there's lots of flavors of private equity, but venture capital, you're clearly looking to invest to supercharge a business to have an exit point when that business goes public or is acquired. Your model is really about building and strengthening a business that the intention is for it to remain private.
Yeah. Yeah, for certain. I mean, our hope, we've tried to build our firm almost like a family, which is to say that, you know, it's we want to hold these things for a generation or more. We want them to be durable and we want them to generate free cash flow that then gives us optionality. You know, we can either distribute it and buy beer with it, or we can reinvest it and continue to help grow the business. So it's you know, it's a different model. You know, I you know, we love it and we think it's really rewarding. but you know, other people, you know, do things differently. Venture capital is, you know, obviously a form of private equity, right? They're making investments in private companies, but certainly, you know, much earlier stage companies, much smaller initial bets, but they've got, you know, very high optionality and variance. Their batting averages are going to tend to be low. Our batting average should be higher because we're buying much more mature cash flowing proven assets, you know, but we think, you know, at the end of the day, you know, investing is about having a job and then getting it done.
So quick follow-up, Tim, it sounds like one of the biggest, if not the biggest thing that your company can, or your private equity firm can bring to the table for a potential partner is money. But I'm wondering, like, what else, what other kinds of things, if I'm the owner of a business and I'm trying to work out a deal with your firm, what are some other things that you guys can bring to the table that make it an attractive partnership for a small business owner?
Yeah. So our chief operating officer is Mark Brooks, who actually also came from The Fool. I recruited him out here after I came and told Mark that, you know, this is pretty fun and he'd enjoy it because Mark's a big business operations geek. And, you know, we've got our businesses and they would not begrudge me saying this. We have a lot of businesses or a lot of problems for them to solve, or they have a lot of problems that need to be solved. And so, you know,
well, it's funny how a lot of those problems, you start with money, right? Money gives you the capacity to solve them. It frees up time. It frees up resources. And then you've got Mark, and this is where the expertise that you have comes in.
Yeah. So we try to, you know, what we say is we're trying to buy businesses that are excellent at their core business. So our pool builder is really good at building pools. You know, our market tech firm in Minnesota, they're really good at helping small businesses advertise on the internet. You know, but where we help is what we call the taste like chicken layer of business. So, you know, we call that marketing. We call that financial management and kind of scorekeeping, hiring. And those are things that for many small business owners, they view them as cost centers. Like, why would you like pay someone to hire for you when you can just ask around town and see if there are any candidates available? You know, our pool business out in Arizona, they advertised a lot on the radio and not on the internet. And we said, why don't we try running some tests on the internet? Because we can find, you know, people in Arizona who don't have pools yet and have young kids, and we can target them in April just as the temperatures are warming up. And that highly targeted advertising turned out to be really successful. And they got a lot more leads as a result of that. You know, we've been able to place CEOs in many of our businesses. You know, we've sped up the time to close books at our picture frame business up in Michigan from like 4 weeks to 2 weeks. And the ability to make a decision based on having accurate financials 2 weeks earlier than you did previously. I mean, it's a huge win in terms of having to run the business. You can buy less inventory, which frees up more cash. You have less working capital. So those are areas where we try to be really, really helpful and good partners. And, you know, like I said, prior to our involvement, they tend to be viewed as cost centers. So they're not really invested in, which means that they're, you know, they're brute force problems to solve. But when you solve them, you get a good payoff. You know, we get asked a lot, like, hey, what's your competitive advantage? What's your special sauce? And it's not rocket science. You know, the ethos around our firm is, you know, say what you're going to do and do it and be highly reliable and kind. And that's it.
Hey, everybody, we'll be right back. But first, a word from our sponsors. Hey, Investing Unscripted listeners, I have a new sponsor I want to tell you about, and it is a website I think you're going to want to check out. It's called finchat.io. And it is a complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. We all have places we go to get information about the stocks we invest in. And FinChat.io is going to become your favorite place to go to get that information. Beyond having all the standard financial data for companies all around the globe, FinChat also has company-specific segments and KPIs, or key performance indicators, on over 1,500 stocks. So, for example, if you want to see what Amazon's AWS revenue was over the past 10 years, or if you want to track Match Group's paying users, FinChat tracks all those KPIs and millions more. It also has beautiful design and institutional quality data. So if you want to make really nice looking charts that show these KPIs or any other information about the stocks you invest in, FinChat is an incredibly powerful and easy way to do that. I use FinChat all the time to look up information about the companies I invest in. I like how it's displayed visually. I find it to be a really helpful platform to use. To get 25% off any paid plan, go to finchat.io/unscripted. That's finchat.io/unscripted to get 25% off any paid plan today. It sounds like people are getting business expertise with you guys. You know, like, so if I'm the pool owner, I might be really good at building pools, but not necessarily marketing or advertising or that kind of stuff. So
yeah, or you're just trying, you know, you're a small business CEO who's trying to wear seven hats. So even if you might be a good marketer,
you just don't have the time.
Yeah, you're spending 11% of your day on it, and then you're trying to do HR over there and negotiate with the landlord over there. You know, things just fall through the cracks. It's not a full-time job.
Well, one of the things you talked about in your recent, just kind of tying into that in a recent newsletter write-up, is that even really great small businesses, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but even really, really great small, medium-sized businesses are anything from a few months to just a few weeks of troubled times away from absolute catastrophe. Mm-hmm. So it sounds to me like a lot of businesses are looking to partner with a firm like you guys. They're looking for a little bit of margin of safety too.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, these are small businesses, so they're inherently fragile in the sense that there are single points of failure. You know, they're not running around with $10 billion of liquidity on their balance sheet with facilities with Goldman and JP Morgan that they can just draw on the event of a crisis. You know, during COVID, obviously the Paycheck Protection PPP loan program had lots of issues and problems. But, you know, for many businesses, it was a real lifeline just because, you know, they had 3 months of cash, but the pandemic was definitely going to last longer than 3 months, and nobody knew what was going to happen, you know, on the other side. So, one of the things we do, you know, right off the bat with our businesses is we audit all the reporting that they generate, you know, and if they're not generating, you know, daily, weekly, monthly cash flow forecasts, you know, we have a template that we immediately build for them to work on that, because cash is the lifeblood of any business. You know, we have a concept around here, which we call like, you know, unconscious reinvestment or inadvertent reinvestment. You know, and this is an example where, you know, the person in charge of AR goes on vacation and nobody picks up the job for a week. And all of a sudden your cash conversion cycle just lengthened by 10 days. And now you're $150,000 short. Or, you know, we've seen this recently at a number of our businesses where larger public companies, obviously, who are customers, you know, the cost of financing things has gone up, right? So if you can squeeze your small supplier and pay them in 75 days instead of, you know, 30, that can be a real boon for these companies and their own balance sheets. And if you're not paying attention as a small business, you're inadvertently financing all of these other businesses from your own balance sheet. And that hurts, that stinks. So we try to make sure every month we look at, hey, what did we quote unquote make on paper? And then how much cash did we actually get in? And if there's a difference between those two numbers, like how big is it and can we explain it? And if we can't explain it, we will be just unconsciously reinvested in the business. Let's figure out where that went and how we might fix it.
So we eventually want to turn the conversation to you as an investor too, and how your switch into private equity has kind of informed the way you look at investing generally. But I have a question about something you just actually hit on, which is higher interest rates. I'm curious what impact higher rates have had on the private equity side of investing.
Yeah. So our experience in our segment of the market, and I don't want to speak broadly because there's a lot of different segments of the market, but in our segment of the market, you know, we have seen, if you rewind 2 to 3 years when interest rates were really low, people who were trying to sell their businesses were getting very aggressive offers with regards to valuation, and getting a lot of them when they came to market, because there were a lot of firms with access to relatively inexpensive other people's money. And so it made for a very competitive environment, but it also made for a very large and broad opportunity set, because, you know, brokers and intermediaries in the space could very credibly go to a small business owner and say, hey, there's never been a better time to sell. You're going to get a lot of offers at good valuations. If you fast forward to today, you know, we, since we don't use debt at all, you know, our value proposition hasn't changed. So we're still underwriting things in the same way. But instead of the competition now being other firms, our perception is that our biggest competition is the status quo, or the seller just deciding not to do anything, because they're really getting our offer and not a whole lot else. Because firms, obviously, if banks are lending at all into the segment, they're lending with much, requiring much larger like co-payments with them. And then also they're putting a lot of covenants around the debt, and it's more expensive. And so that combination of three things has kind of slowed down the marketplace a little bit. So the businesses that we're seeing over the past 6 months, call it, are more businesses that really need to do something. You know, somebody had a health scare, or somebody really needs liquidity, those types of situations. So, you know, we're still seeing opportunities. We're under LOI with the business right now that we're really excited about. But the pace has slowed down sort of over the past, call it, I guess, how long have interest rates been up? Like 9 to 12 months.
So combination of, maybe just to summarize that a little bit. So maybe less less engagement in terms of like the number of potential opportunities, but probably more qualified conversations.
Yeah. Well, I would say there are more quick yeses, but also more quick no's. Because a lot of times when somebody has to do something, something has gone wrong and we're not probably a great fit for that.
Right.
You know, one thing that will be interesting here is all the debt that people took out in 2021 and 2022, you know, arguably that stuff probably had 3 to 5 year terms on it, which means there are a whole bunch of people who are going to need to try to have an exit here over the next 12 to 24 months into a slow marketplace, which could have a very interesting follow through impact on returns for private equity firms, returns for private equity writ large, and then also sort of the opportunity environment, the deal making environment here going forward. So, you know, we try to just always be ready for whatever the world's going to throw at us. That's one of the reasons we don't use debt. You know, we're able to, you know, our other ethos around the office is that we want to do what makes sense 100% of the time and what doesn't make sense 0% of the time. We don't always get that right, but that is kind of how we prepare for things.
Well, funny, sometimes we think we always know the answer to that, but we always find out the true answer to that after the fact, right?
So yeah, sometimes feedback loops are pretty slow.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
No, that's true. That's true. And it's interesting seeing exactly what you're talking about play out in the public equities market as well. Obviously, you look at real estate. So many REITs are still well down, particularly in certain sectors, because that public REIT market adjusts really quickly to the realities of debt. And it's been slower to play out in the public equities market. So it's interesting to hear the observations of the kind of the private side of the business where things are being affected too. Let's go ahead and make that shift over and talk a little bit about Tim Hansen, the individual investor. And as a starting point, we kind of hinted at it before, making that transition from working more in the public equities world, working for a company with a 401k where you can buy individual stocks or invest in ETFs and funds and that sort of thing. And now working in private equity, having access to participate financially in private equity, but also still thinking about liquidity and, you know, money you're going to need to spend in the next 27 years. I'm curious to kind of hear how you've evolved over the past 5 years or so and how private equity has informed how you think about investing as an individual investor.
You know, it's funny. I don't really draw a line between the two. I mean, I think of risk reward as just like an ongoing battle between like good and evil, or, you know, so what have you. Like risk is on one shoulder and reward is on the other.
Right.
You know, I think my biggest learning probably over my investing career is that, you know, there is no such thing as safe risk, or there is no medium risk. Like you're either taking risk or you're not. And if you're taking medium risk, you're deceiving yourself about kind of the circumstances that you put yourself into. So, you know, 2008-09, you know, banking stocks typically were considered very, very safe, right? They made up a huge part of the S&P 500. They were considered blue chips. They paid dividends, all these sorts of things. And lurking beneath them was all this toxic stuff that nobody knew what they were doing. And so,
Even the executives running those companies.
Exactly right. And, you know, and they thought that by, you know, tranching those loan books into different segments, that you could have a risky sleeve and a less risky sleeve, you know, and that's all, it's all BS. Like it's either risk or it's not. And so, you know, that's been one learning of mine. So in terms of investing, like I invest in stuff that I think can earn very high return. Like personally speaking, I invest in stuff that I think can earn very high returns, or I have cash. That's it. And,
yep,
you know, and if it's, I don't, you know, like a dangerous game for me would be like, oh, I've got too much cash, so why don't I stick it in a utility stock? Or why don't I stick it in, you know, these medium term treasuries, you know, right before interest rates skyrocket and the treasury market gets cut, you know, by 25%. Like the length of time it takes to make up for a 25% loss on a treasury is enormous.
You can't do it.
You got to hold it to maturity at that point. And
right.
On paper.
And that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the reality is that 95% of retail investors, they don't own bonds, right? The ones that own bonds, they own ETFs, right? So talking about completely erasing their ability, because those bond managers they're flipping those bonds already, and your loss is booked. It's absolutely booked. If you don't own the bond and you can't hold it to maturity,
and
you invested in a bond fund, you're hosed.
I mean, that was ultimately what, you know, the story behind what took down Silicon Valley Bank, right? Which was like, they invested in all this medium, low risk stuff on their balance sheet, then it gets nuked because interest rates go up unexpectedly. And now, because of the way they're regulated, you know, they can't hold it to maturity and their capital ratios have gotten destroyed and all of a sudden they're bankrupt on paper. You know, that I think is, you know, you're either, like I said, no medium risk. You're either safe or you're not. And you can even argue that cash isn't safe, but you know, you got to go.
But it's predictable.
It's true. You know how it will behave, you know, and I'm not trying to come off as a prepper or anything like that. Like I take plenty of risk in other areas of the portfolio, but like I said, you know, either you're going for returns or you're not and don't half-ass it.
Do you have an example in mind, Tim, of like maybe earlier investor you that did fool yourself into thinking you were invested in something that had medium risk?
Oh, you know, I've been very candid about this. You know, when we were starting at The Fool, you know, I got very fortunate to travel to a lot of emerging markets. And, you know, emerging markets are considered a pretty risky place, right? But, you know, you in terms of business quality and people, and I mean, in China, for example, you know, I was naive at the beginning part of my career about just the amount of deception taking place at even very well-established companies with regards to accounting and so on and so forth. You know, I was naive about the amount that currency can turn against you if you're investing dollars in a, you know, if you've got dollars and you buy shares of a great Indian company and the company performs great, but the rupee devalues by 30% against the dollar, well, you have no return. You've probably lost quite a bit of money for taking a risk you didn't. Not only did you, I mean, the most dangerous risks are the risks you take without assessing the risk of them, or you inadvertently take the risk and didn't think about it. So, you know, there's that hedging stuff. You know, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, the best way to learn is to lose very small amounts of money as a young person. And I did that for certain. So, you know, all you know, if you talk to people around the office, you know, I don't know that they would describe me as cynical or paranoid, but when we see numbers, you know, taken with a grain of salt, especially in the private space. You know, I said beer money earlier. I mean, that's literally what we've started calling what we underwrite our investments to, which is, hey, it's not worth anything unless we can literally take it and go buy beer with it. We can also call it distributable free cash flow. You know, but, you know, we were laughing today. I don't know. There was a story about the accounting at Starlink, the Tesla, Elon Musk, you know, satellite right. company, and how he had called it in the zone of profitable. And then they had somebody say, oh, yeah, they've got numbers that they send to their investors and they add back. And we see add backs all the time in the materials we get from businesses where they're adding back the costs of launching the satellites because those are all one-time events. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's wild. And so you got to scrutinize all that stuff. And, you know, not to date myself, but, you know, if you go back, there was Groupon with like WeWork had community adjusted EBITDA. Groupon had ACSOI or consolidated ACSOI, where despite being a marketing business, they added back their marketing expenses as one time. You know, people are, you know, numbers can be.
Well, it's the saying about statistics, right? It's just numbers, you torture them the right way, they're going to say exactly what you want them to say.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, you got to double check everything. You know, the nice thing about, you know, when we do diligence here, in some ways, we're taking more risk in a variety of ways than you would investing in a large public company, you know, but we ask and we receive all the bank statements for any business that we want to invest in. You know, good luck asking Google or Amazon to give you their bank statements. I mean, it'll never happen. And maybe you trust that the auditor is doing the work to verify all that stuff. But, you know, I think there's been a lot of evidence over the last number of years that, you know, even white glove audit firms are not fully doing their jobs or, you know, are not truly independent. And so, you know, we make the joke that a lot of the financial industry is sort of just held together by like Excel and bubblegum. And at least we're in a segment of the market that's willing to admit that. But Jamie Dimon never would admit probably how many things at JP Morgan are being held on very manually updated spreadsheets.
Yeah, no, it's true. It reminds me a little of something I saw on social media that I think was just hilarious. And I think it reminds me a little bit of what probably happens with some of the auditing firms and some of the things with businesses. It was a retired Major League Baseball umpire who was talking about bad days at work, typically following good nights out, where he would actually trust certain catchers. And he would tell them, he's like, it was a bad day. You know, it's just going to be a bad day. So if it's a strike, I want you to hold it a little longer. If it's a ball, throw it back quick. And so then he's calling it based on what the catcher is doing.
I had
you know
this story. That's funny.
Yeah. So that is just imagining that, you know, some, even if it's small versions of that happening in the real world, they do. So it is interesting, like with private equity, anytime you're buying a private business where you're the onus of due diligence and trusting the information is more on you than anything else. But once you become a large stakeholder, especially for permanent equity, like I said, where you're buying controlling stake, you actually have the ability to really directly influence the business, right? Because mm-hmm. you can tell them what to do when it comes down to it. And unless your name is Carl Icahn, you can't do that in private markets. So I'm curious, thinking about, again, the individual investor, where we truly, once we buy, and of course, hope is a terrible thesis, but we do kind of buy in hope, right? At the end of the day, we have to, you know, we're hoping that everything we have, we can trust and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
What are some things that you think most individual investors maybe should focus on that they actually can control as an investor?
I mean, your temperament, you know, yeah. that's the number. I mean, I think it's old saw at this point. I don't think it was when I started investing. You know, I think it was, you know, behavioral economics and those things were just sort of going into the mainstream. Obviously, like Danny Kahneman, who recently passed away, and Amos Tversky started doing that stuff, you know, 50 years ago. But yeah. I don't think, you know, bless his heart, more people like Morgan weren't writing best-selling global books about it until, you know, probably five to 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But that stuff is just so important because, you know, bad decisions are what kill you. Like if you make a mediocre decision, but you hang in there long enough, you're probably going to be okay. It's when you make like a rash, bad decision, you know, something drops 30%, you sell it and lock in that loss. Like that takes a lot to recover from. And so just, you know, being patient, not panicking, you know, when COVID happened, like I opened up my Ameritrade account and saw how much money I had lost. And I was like, well, it'll be back eventually. And I think, you know, from what I've been reading, you know, the academic literature, before everybody got their stimulus checks and started, you know, gambling on meme stocks, a lot of people sold in that week after that drop and locked in a lot of losses, which is sad and unfortunate. So, you know, I think no matter what you're investing in, whether, you know, asset classes are asset classes and there are a million of them. And I'm not here to say that our little slice of private equity is the best or Joe's venture capital or, you know, all the guys on real estate Twitter who are building incredible apartment buildings around the world. You know, all those things are different strategies, but the thing that underpins them all is like it's very, like successful investors have very common traits with regards to their ability to tolerate loss, their ability to be patient, you know, their ability to not do anything. Like if there's nothing to be done, you don't need to do anything. Like the bias to action is just a killer. You know, we didn't do a single deal in 2020 because, you know, the numbers in the operating results were really distorted. People had high expectations. There was a lot of uncertainty. And we, you know, we obviously don't get paid to do nothing, but we have time to do nothing. And so we didn't do anything. And it was great. And obviously that was a year that if you're comparing us to like a public benchmark, you know, we got hammered, you know, because zero is a lot less than, you know, plus 20 or whatever it ended up being. But we were fine with that. We're happy looking stupid. You know, we don't really, you know, we're not irreverent. We care, but, you know, we're trying to just thoughtfully play the long game.
Every time I think about how the information age has sort of taken away a lot of the advantages that maybe investors had 30, 40 years ago, it does make me think that the only advantage we actually do have now is temperament. If your ability mm-hmm. to not do something rash versus someone else's decision to do something rash is probably the biggest edge we all can have as individual investors. A lot easier to do than say for most people, but I feel like that's the only place we really have an edge.
I mean, in the public markets, I agree with you 100%. I mean, and to go back to my earlier point, that was one of the reasons why I moved from public to private because, you know, and the public.
So you really are paranoid, Tim.
Yeah, I'm paranoid and cynical.
Okay.
Well, you know, because everybody can see the same stocks. Everybody's, you know, I'm with AI and stuff like screening tools, for example, have just gotten incredibly powerful. Like anybody, like what, you know, any dude in a, you know, in their boxer shorts can basically do now what Jim Simon started at Renaissance Technologies, you know, 40 years ago. And they have more computing power than he had access to. And,
yeah. You know, in their incredible. Pocket.
Yeah. 100%. And so, you know, like I said, you know, in our line of work, we think we can have some advantages with regards to how we operate the businesses and then also how we cultivate kind of proprietary deal flow and see things that other people aren't seeing. But that's, you know, that's really hard too. But, you know, temperament and mindset, that is a lot of what it comes down to.
So I'm sure you follow the financial news like the rest of us, Tim. So like the big news story in markets for the past year or so has been AI. It seems to be in every single earnings call, whether or not, whether the company has an actual tie to AI or not. So I'm curious if you have any
even
sort of
Warren
hot takes
Buffett managed
on,
to manage to get a mention of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, this is all totally for SEO for us, by the way.
All good.
He was
all
doing.
Good.
He was being tongue in cheek, but yeah, we're doing it for SEO.
I am curious if you have any hot takes on AI writ large, but also I'm curious if the proliferation of AI over the past year and you know generative AI and all that stuff has had any impact on the way you guys do your business.
So a couple, yeah. So we are watching with open eyes about all the developments in the space because we're of two minds. On the one hand, you know, small businesses are always starved for resources. And so to the extent that artificial intelligence can become a resource that can automate a whole bunch of tasks for small businesses, that is potentially a huge win. You know, and I can tell you, you know, one of our guys in our building who helps do projects with special projects with their businesses, you know, one of our businesses is a, call it 70-year-old manufacturer of amusement park rides. And they've got thousands of user manuals for each one of these rides. And when someone who owns a carousel that was built in 1974 calls up and needs a replacement part, you know, the parts team has to go, or had to physically go pull the paper manual from the library, page through it in order to find what they were looking for, and then give the advice about how to fix it. And they digitized all that stuff. And then I think used one of the AI programs, I'm not sure which one, to basically create a chatbot that can answer 95% of the questions that are coming in about these 50-year-old amusement park rides that may need service or may need a replacement part. And they're already estimating that they've saved that team like a month of time over the course of a year, which is incredible. So we're looking for opportunities like that all the time. On the flip side, something that's, you know, the danger side of it we see for small businesses is that most of these AI technologies are very expensive to develop, and they seem like they're being deployed by larger technology businesses that historically have had a strong bias towards consolidation. And so, you know, Amazon just likes to gobble up more and more and more pie for itself and vertically integrate and so on and so forth. And, you know, we've seen some of our small businesses that used to, you know, sell via Amazon. Amazon is now gone direct to China. They figured it all out, and they're using technology to basically circumvent, you know, suppliers in many ways. And so to the extent AI ends up being a tool developed by big business for big business, you know, we see that as a risk factor. So I think there's both opportunity and danger, but obviously very fast moving and very interesting.
Yeah. We had Simon Erickson on a few weeks ago. One of the things he talked about is, you know, the AI bubble versus inflection point. And I think that's a really key way to think about it for me. And I'm interested to see how, as it plays out, as we do see more consolidation and these big businesses, these enterprises acquire more, but also spend money to develop AI, access to it for small and medium-sized businesses to be able to leverage it in the ways you're talking about, in ways that are affordable, right? That's going to be...
Well, yeah, because you also need the... You know, I can tell you none of our businesses have a software programmer on staff other than our ad tech business in Minnesota. You know, it's not something they'd ever think about hiring for, and, you know, and is somebody who can do programming going to go work for a pool builder in Arizona? Like, probably not. So you got to find some way to not just access this technology, but also find someone who's fluent in it.
Well, it's going to be fun to follow. That's for sure. Tim,
I agree.
Tim, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for giving us a peek into your world.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. No, I enjoyed talking with you guys. That flew by for me. So appreciate y'all.
They do. We're a lot of fun. We're a lot of fun. One last question for you.
Yes, sir.
Where can the people find you?
In terms of, here in Columbia, Missouri is where we call home. And we're always happy to host people at Permanent Equity if people have interest. We get a lot of visitors. We actually host two events every year here, one called Capital Camp in May, and then another, which is, you know, exciting, maybe applicable to folks in your audience, called Main Street Summit, which will be in October. We had 1,000 people here last year just talking about small business, operating them, running them, investing in them, being a service provider to them. So, you know, those both have websites, and we'd love to people come visit. You know, our website is permanentequity.com. You can sign up for Unqualified Opinions there, which is our daily newsletter, and then get all of our other stuff. You know, on Twitter, I'm Tim Hanso, T-I-M-H-A-N-S-O. I tweet a lot about, sometimes about investing, but a lot about mushrooms and stuff I see in the woods, because when we moved to Missouri, we decided if we were going to leave D.C., we'd go real rural. So we live about 12 miles outside of town here on some land in the woods, which is a lot of fun. Yeah, so I'm around.
Awesome. All right, people, I'm going to make it easy for you. Just go to investingunscripted.com and sign up for the newsletter. It's going to be in the transcript. We'll have all the links there. Jeff will work with our producers and make sure everything is in the description too in your podcast app. So
Yeah.
Make it easy for people to find Tim.
I just have to decide like which producer to bring it to. But yeah, we'll figure that out.
Right. Right. That's true. Jeff is our producer, people.
Man of many hats and a very good friend, right?
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Tim, once again, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate you. Be well.
Okay, everybody. Hang out for just a couple more minutes because Jeff and I are going to give our thoughts on our conversation with Tim. Plus, we want to share our thoughts on our 100th episode, our official 100th episode. That's coming up after a quick break.
Earlier in the show, you heard us talk about investingplatformpublic.com. That's where you can trade options with no commissions or per contract fees. And you get a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. NerdWallet recently gave Public 5 out of 5 stars for options trading. If you want to see why, go to public.com and start getting a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. Paid for by Public Investing. Options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures and podcast description, U.S. members only.
Hey, Jeff, you ready to make the jump into private equity?
Every time we have a guest on who does something different, I'm always thinking to myself, like, this would be a fun job to have. I had the same thought when we had Joe on to talk about venture capital. So yes, I'm ready. I'll send my resume to Tim. I'll move to Missouri and jump into private equity. If he was the most unqualified CFO ever, I would be the most unqualified private equity employee ever.
You can break that. You can break that record, right?
Yeah. I thought that was really interesting. When he was talking about what they offer what they offer to a company with whom they partner up, it reminded me of, this is going to be a little bit of a weird tangent, but the company DigitalOcean, because they do infrastructure, cloud infrastructure, like AWS or Google Cloud.
But they target small to medium-sized businesses.
Right, their whole pitch is basically, when you're a small business, you don't have the time, the headcount, or the expertise to manage your cloud stuff, so let us do it, right? That's the one sentence, kind of quick pitch for them. And it reminds me a lot of what Permanent Equity does for the companies that they take a stake in, which is basically, you know, he used the pool company as the example. You're great at building pools, and you may even be good at marketing or advertising, but you just don't have the time for that. We'd rather you take the time to build pools, so we'll do that for you. Like, I thought that was an interesting way to, you know, an interesting flavor of private equity, as he put it, that I had not ever thought of. It was always the barbarians at the gate kind of thing in my head.
Yeah, no, I think it's one of my favorite things when we have guests on like that is learning something that I didn't know, right? That's just completely unrelated to kind of the things that we focus on. And Jeff, that's hard for me because I know so many things. Yeah, I'm humble too. I'm most humble. I know more about being humble than anybody. But no, seriously, but you're right. It's getting the opportunity to kind of scratch that kind of intellectual curiosity itch. And I've followed Tim pretty closely for just about, I don't think I'm probably 2 weeks into him writing Unqualified Opinions. I subscribed to it. So I've read most of them and it's been really interesting. So I knew Permanent Equity, like they had a long, long investment period that you commit your capital to. I didn't realize it was 27 years though.
Yeah. Yeah. That was surprising.
I did the math and I'll be in my 70s, right? If I committed capital to one of their deals. And that's remarkable. And it reminds me of the interview we did with Brian Withers. This is going back a ways, one of our early interviews, where one of the things Brian talked about, and Brian is semi-retired. For those that don't follow Brian or didn't hear the interview, again, link's going to be in the transcript. In his early 50s, he walked away from a corporate job and kind of semi-retired. He reached that level of financial independence. But one of the things that he talked about is that making that transition, like learning what long-term really means. And it's not 3 to 5 years, right? Until you're measuring in decades, you're really not truly thinking long-term.
Yeah. No, for sure. I thought that was interesting too. When he said 27 years, I was like, wow, that is a long time. That is serious commitment to locking up your capital. I think the last thing that I'll say that kind of jumped out at me, Tim didn't say this directly, but I got the vibe that one of the things that he's really come to realize / appreciate about the work he does now is having so much, I don't want to say control, but having so much inside knowledge where he really can't get BS'd by the company because he can see everything, right? He mentioned being able to have bank statements and all that kind of stuff. And how much, when you're a public equities investor like we are, you are just putting your faith in basically the SEC and the auditing company for the company that you're investing in, that everything's on the up and up. And then you have to have enough knowledge to see through adjusted numbers and when management wants to spin something to make it look like it's not as bad as it is or better than it is. You know, I would imagine if he were to move back into something with public equities, that would be a hard thing to transition back into, having less knowledge, having less security in the information, or less confidence in the information that you're getting to make a decision.
Well, it's the difference between being an investor and being an owner, right? And you know, we talk about it here as kind of in the toolbox, is like having more of that owner mentality, remembering that you don't own a business, right? It's just not lines on a screen, theoretical values. You know, you own a business and it's generating cash flows and it's doing things and making products and services, and remembering that. But I mean, it is more than just a theoretical thought process with what they do. They own the businesses, right?
They see
the actual bank statements. They have meetings with the owners that report to them, right? It's a very different state. I think that's interesting. Jeff, yeah. is there a question that we didn't ask Tim that you wish we had have asked?
I mean, I had a lot of my own, like, because I'm just all still newish to me, questions that I would want to ask if we could go back, but they would have been just for me and probably not as interesting for everyone else. Like, I'm big on examples. So like, I would have loved to know, tell me the entire story of one company, like what, how the deal came to be, what you did for them, how it's turned out. Like, I have a lot of, you know, minutia kind of details, so I can kind of wrap my head around what private equity in the way that they do it really is. So that would kind of be the only thing I would ask. I'm actually curious if anyone is listening to this and has their own questions about private equity, send them to us. We could actually follow up with Tim if we don't know the answers ourselves and maybe hit him on the next mailbag. But I would be interested to know what the listeners thought, especially if the topic of private equity was newish to them as well.
Yeah, if you're reading the transcript, you can comment on there. You can put your questions there too, if that's the easiest way to get to them, get them to us. So yeah, I like that. I like that idea. I can't really think of anything that I didn't ask. It was just a good conversation all around. Jeff, I want to do one more thing before we go, though. 100 episodes. I want to share some thoughts.
Go ahead.
That's a lot of episodes.
I'm exhausted.
Me too. I mean,
well, it is. And I think it is a landmark worth spending 30 seconds on. I knew we hit 100 total episodes a couple weeks ago because there's a count thing on the Spotify page that we upload to. So if you count the first Fridays and the rough cuts, we were actually hit 100 total episodes a little while ago. But yeah
we're like 115 total at this point.
But having 100, like I said, like the planned out weekly on purpose ones is a nice little milestone. I remember when we started, Brian Withers, who you just mentioned, said to us, he gave us some statistic, like 80% of podcasts don't make it past 5 or 10 episodes or something like that, or 20, whatever the number was. And I can totally understand how that happens. You do a handful and you lose the fun and you stop. But this is as fun for me now as it was in episode one. So
yeah, I think in some ways I might be enjoying it more, to be honest with you.
Are you trying to one-up me because I said I'm having as much fun?
No, I am one-upping you. I'm not trying. There is no try. There's only do or do not. So no.
Why would you say that you're having more fun now?
Well, I think we're better at it. Number one, we've been doing this long enough that we've refined it and we've kind of figured out what works for us. And we've got the cadence and the time that we do different things, not to bore people with kind of the making of the sausage. But the other part of it too is the people that are listening. We have a lot of engagement on social media that's really useful. Great questions. A few of you have questions and ideas that you send to us sometimes that turn into shows. And that's really helpful and really, really useful. So,
and we have the occasional listener who trolls us in a very good-hearted way, and I'm always appreciative of that.
Yeah, that might be the best part. That really might be the best part. Jeff, here's to the next 100 episodes.
Yes, man, I'm looking forward to it. Let's stop and reflect one more time when we get to 200.
Sounds like a good idea to me. Okay, as always, we love to give our answers, observations, thoughts, and have great people like Tim Hansen come on to do the same thing. But the answers that we give are our answers. It is up to you, dear listener, to answer your own questions about these hard investing topics. You can do it. After 100 times telling you can do it, I still believe in you.
All right, Jeff. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.